This is for professional and institutional clients only.
Fundamentally, the issue is one of trust. If you, as an investor, are going to say, we are committed to improving, you had better deliver on that or you're going to lose the trust of your investors. And so it's really a chain, but we need to crack it. And we just don't have an alternative. I mean, we have to.
Welcome to the Ignio Infrastructure Partners podcast, Keeping It Real Assets. In this series, you will hear from the Ignio investment team in conversation with the leaders of our global infrastructure businesses. We will shine a light on how they operate and their approach to the challenges of an ever-changing world. We hope that you enjoy listening.
Hello, and welcome to this latest edition of Ignio Infrastructure Partners podcast, Keeping It Real Assets. My name is Sophie Durham, and I'm head of ESG for Europe at Ignio. I'm joined today by Karina Litvak. Karina is an expert, in fact, a trailblazer, in corporate governance and sustainable investment. Karina has a 25-year career in finance and sustainable business practice. Karina currently serves as an independent non-executive director on the board of Terna, the Italian electricity transmission system operator, and recently stepped down after 9 years on the board of Italian oil and gas major Eni. Karina has also served on the board of several other organizations, including the Climate Governance Initiative, the CFA Institute, and Business for Social Responsibility. And before all of that, Karina ran the governance and sustainable investment activities of F&C Investments, the UK institutional investor. So safe to say we could not be speaking to someone more experienced. So thank you very much for joining us, Karina.
Thank you, Sophie. Thank you so much for having me.
I should add that Karina is speaking to us in her personal capacity today, not as a representative of any of the businesses she is or has been involved in. Karina, I think if we could start off by talking about the role of boards in advancing ESG issues. So obviously a key focus of yours recently has been the Climate Governance Initiative, which aims to mobilize and support non-executive directors to place climate change at the heart of their board's business strategies. We at Ignio, we aim to own a majority stake in the companies that we invest in and always have board representation. So it's a key way that we seek to drive change and drive improvements in our portfolio companies. So perhaps we could start by asking what you see as the key role of board directors in driving progress on ESG issues.
Yes, well, thank you for the question. You know, when I joined the board of Eni or ENI in 2014, my first realization was just how difficult it was, much harder than it seems from the vantage point of being an investor, for the board to really embed sustainability and particularly the climate transition. It's one thing to talk about health and safety and operational effectiveness and even anti-corruption and even human rights, but climate transition was just so overwhelming in its complexity that I really was at a loss. And when I looked around at fellow directors in my own board and in other boards, I really just couldn't find the answers. And so I really felt it was necessary to create something that would help directors find guidance on what they needed to do, like a how-to manual. And so to answer your question, I think that first and foremost, you want to have directors who understand the urgency and the enormity of the challenge. It's not that they need to be climate experts per se. And in fact, sometimes having very, very deep expertise can be a little bit of a complicating factor on a board because you want people to be fundamentally oriented towards enabling the business. But sometimes enabling the business means transforming the business. And that means understanding the implications of climate change for a given business. And so that leadership really, really needs to come from the board. And there needs to be a sense that the board owns this and drives this. And too often what you see is people at mid-level in companies who desperately want to do the right thing, but they are stymied because there are so many competing priorities at the level between them and the board. So unless the board really takes this on, it can get stuck. And so that's fundamentally what the Climate Governance Initiative and all the chapter zeros in our 70 countries of operation is about.
I really like that description of if you're too far down in the weeds, that actually can be challenging. And the role of the board is in strategic direction.
Correct.
And focusing on strategic risks, not being down in the weeds. And so I think Correct. That's a really great articulation of what it means to be a good director and what your role actually is.
Exactly.
So I guess a related question is, Ignio, we have 5 minimum standards for ESG performance, and one of them is around good governance. And there are certain things we require, like having independent directors on all of our boards, having risk registers in place, having certifications in place. So it is a key focus of ours. What do you think are the tools that directors need to be able to engage effectively on this topic? And what should we at Ignio be putting in place to empower and enable our directors, both the Ignio directors on our boards, but also the independent directors that we have on all our boards as well? What do we need to be doing to help them engage on these issues and push forwards progress with management?
Okay, I think the answer to that question happens on 2 levels. One is the practical objective tools, which you might even call technical tools. So what you referred to just now of proper risk management systems, which, you know, historically have not been particularly well tailored to dealing with, if you're talking about climate change in particular, the complexity and the systemic nature and the interdependencies that are typical of climate change. So you want to have those tools at the disposal of the directors, whether it's that or understanding how the transition feeds into scenario planning and into not only your standard 3 to 5 year strategic planning, but your 10 year and your 27 year, if we're 2023 today, looking at 2050 strategic planning, we need to think differently about planning so that we're looking at different horizons contemporaneously and looking at how they interact. And then looking at how that feeds into audit and stress testing and impairments, and looking at how that feeds into remuneration and how that feeds into skills mapping on the human capital front. So these are all your quite practical tasks that different committees have to look at. However, even if you make that array of tools available to your directors, there's still one fundamental ingredient that could be missing. And this is where I think Ignio could really play a critical role. And that is in giving your directors that comfort that challenge is welcome. And I know that may sound like a cliche, but I have seen this so many times. I have seen it happen that people who in a one-on-one conversation outside the boardroom absolutely understand what the stakes are, completely agree that we need to do something, and then suddenly in the boardroom, crickets. And that's a question of courage, confidence, call it what you will. There needs to be a signal coming from the chair of the board or the owner or whoever it is that really calls the shots to say, we welcome this discussion, we need this discussion, and we want to hear it within the four walls of the boardroom, because what we don't want to do is read about it in the newspaper next week. We want to get your input here so that we can bottom out what these problems are and think together what the solutions are. And that is often what is missing. And I see this again and again with directors who come to me privately to say, oh, you know, I'm so tired of being that one annoying person on the board who brings up this issue. Time and again, I'm losing the will to do it, because who wants to be that person? So you want to encourage that person, and you want to encourage others to participate in that kind of really challenging reflection. So that, I think, is probably the single greatest tool, but you can't really find it in a toolbox. It's an abstract thing.
It's intangible. It's about creating the culture and
exactly.
the safe space and the environment where directors can speak up and do, because that's what they're there for.
Exactly.
And to manage risks in our companies. Moving on from that, one debate we frequently see in the ESG world is what we call the improvements versus exclusions debate, whether it's better just not to invest in a company that may be facing ESG challenges, to exclude them, or to invest and drive change and use your ownership and your role in the board to actually make improvements at the company. Where do you sit on that, the exclusions versus improvements debate?
Well, obviously, by virtue of who I am and what I do, I exist in the engagement part of that spectrum. However, I do absolutely want to recognize the role that exclusion plays in making my job easier. Because the truth of the matter is, there's always going to be a camp of investors who will not touch a particular set of companies or specific activities for lots of reasons, actually. It could be because it just clashes with their values, and who are we or anybody else to disagree? I mean, that's their choice. Mm-hmm. And you see this particularly with pension funds of religious organizations or health charities or whatever their motivation may be. It's entirely within their rights. And now certainly legal doctrine has concluded that they have the right to do that if their beneficiaries, their stakeholders, support it. And that, of course, motivates companies to do more and better for fear of facing what we call headwinds in the capital markets, right? We don't want to, if we're listed, or if you're looking at potentially, you know, selling a company later into the listed markets, or even if you're looking for debt, you don't want to be faced with a financial institution that says, sorry, we don't touch that. It's not good for your business, particularly if it's insurance. You don't get insurance, you shut your doors, right? Some investors do it because they see that, well, their assessment is that the risks associated with this business are going to manifest sooner than others in the market seem to think. But if you flip to the other side of the spectrum, that doesn't solve the problem fundamentally. And we're seeing this particularly now in the financial services industry, where with, for all the right reasons and with all good intentions, a number of banks and insurance companies and asset managers a few years ago recognized, rightly, that their financed emissions, their insured emissions, basically the emissions that were generated by investee companies and clients, were so large that they dwarfed anything that the banks could do in their direct operations. And so they set targets to reduce those indirect emissions. The difficulty, though, in execution is that it's enormously tempting to just exit those relationships, particularly when, as has been the case, banks have tried for years to engage with clients and have been unsuccessful. And this is the difficulty with the let's improve rather than exclude approach, is that it's awfully difficult to achieve and you need to have a lot of clout. It's difficult. It's laborious. It requires deep expertise. And, you know, most banks are not equipped to do that. So it's much easier said than done. And of course, it raises the next question, which I suspect we will get to, which is greenwashing. But fundamentally, the issue is one of trust. If you as an investor are going to say, we are committed to improving, you had better deliver on that or you're going to lose the trust of your investors. And so it's really a chain, but we need to crack it and we just don't have an alternative. I mean, we have to.
Yeah. So as you know, Igneo sits on the improvements end of that spectrum. Right. And in terms of clout, I think we actually have a unique opportunity with our portfolio companies because we usually own 100% or a majority stake and we always have board representation. So we have the governance structure that we need in order to drive progress. But also we're a very long-term investor. So we're holding our companies for a minimum of 10 years, but we're thinking in terms of decades. So decisions made about the company, we're thinking what's good for this company in the next 10, 20, 30 years. So I think the nature of our investment strategy gives us a unique opportunity and a really important opportunity to make improvements because our whole strategy is about sustainable value creation. And I mean sustainable there in terms of time, right? Long-term value creation is our investment strategy. But that can't be achieved without actually having real-world sustainability outcomes as well in the form of environmental and social improvements. I think we've seen the debate shift in just the last few years, where, as you were saying, initially everyone kind of rushed into the exclusion argument. But we're seeing more and more investors move back into the improvement space as people start to recognize that actually that's where we need to make more progress. But as you said, you then have to be able to demonstrate that progress. And that can be quite challenging. But also recently, it's faced a lot of scrutiny because of some high-profile cases of greenwashing, some high-profile investigations, a lot of headlines and concerns around greenwashing. So what do we do about that? If we put it back to directors, how can directors know whether real progress is being made? And how can companies and investors communicate on that and avoid risks of greenwashing, but also avoid allegations of that? Build trust, I guess.
My first thing about greenwashing is do not let it chill ambition, because it is so often used as a crutch for not setting ambitious targets. How many times have I heard companies say, we don't want to be a leader. We don't want to put our head above the parapet. That's a recipe for having it shut off. We just want to be respectable and at best a fast follower. I'm sorry. You know what? Because if everyone takes that attitude, we won't have any leaders. That's just not sustainable. So there has to be an acknowledgement of the fact that this does come with risks. And I personally think that the best thing that one can do in that circumstance is to be transparent about the challenges. In other words, to say upfront, this is the best we're able to do today, based on the knowledge we have, to the best of our knowledge, all of those hedge words that are genuine. And also a year or two or three from now, looking back saying, uh-oh, we actually got this one wrong. This is why. And now we're rectifying it. And I can't think of a better way to build trust with stakeholders who may be dubious than to just be upfront about the nature of those challenges. In my new company, all of its debt is green debt. And that's a really nice place to be when you say, we don't need to ring fence a particular set of activities to be financed by this piece of debt, because 100% of what we're doing is about electrifying the grid. But not everyone is in that fortunate position. But fundamentally, we need to be open about the nature of that challenge and just get on with it. Now, interestingly, in the United States, there's this concept of safe harbor, which is that legally a sort of safe space is created to allow for potential error over a defined period of time, following which that's it, your free pass expires. But here we don't have that in Europe, and there's no intention of creating that legal protection. And therefore, the only alternative is to just rely on our own ability to communicate transparently.
I think it's such a good point. People call it green hushing, right?
The yes.
Fear of being called out
yeah.
on something is
yeah.
just going to quieten us all down, and that people won't set targets.
It's tragic. That's the worst outcome.
For example, at Ignio, we ask all our portfolio companies to set emissions reduction targets. They have to be in line with net zero by 2050, and they have to involve some interim emissions reduction targets. But some of our companies, that's really easy to do. There's some low-hanging fruit. We buy 100% green electricity and we electrifies our vehicle fleet. And for that company, that will be enough. But there are other companies where setting these targets, especially the longer-term targets, involves some uncertainty. No one knows what the world's going to look like in 2050 and which technologies are going to dominate. Which fuels will we all be using? Is it going to be hydrogen? Is it going to be electricity? It involves a lot of uncertainty. And that's difficult for companies to navigate. I think what I really like about your answer there is that it's like, don't let that stop you from setting targets, but be transparent about where your targets are uncertain. So you say, X percent of our emissions, we know how we're going to get rid of them. And these are specific operational changes we're going to make. X percent of our targets, we don't know right now how we're going to achieve it, but we're setting that ambition. And once you've set that ambition at the board, you will inevitably have to demonstrate progress or have to demonstrate that you're looking into it. But it's not greenwashing, it's just honesty.
Absolutely right. And by the way, uncertainty is not exactly a foreign concept in the world of business. I mean, we deal with uncertainty all the time in every other domain. So I don't accept that as a reason not to move forward. We just have to manage that uncertainty exactly in the way that you describe.
So I think it's safe to say, all of that being said, that these and other debates have put ESG in the spotlight in the last couple of years. Various different ways of talking about ESG now would include, is it just woke capitalism? Is it a dangerous placebo, a distraction from governments that are the ones that need to make the real change? Or is it, as Elon Musk called it, a scam? What are your thoughts on that? But perhaps I think what's most interesting is, what are the useful things we can take from those criticisms into the world of ESG?
What's true is that there's been a huge surge in interest and lots of people entering the field and lots of people simply rebranding existing products, particularly in the investment field, as ESG. And they've been caught out in many cases for greenwashing. And I would guess that some of those accusations of greenwashing are justified, because it takes a certain degree of effort to go from a standard product to something that is non-standard. So those are the growing pains of rapid growth. But what we're seeing in the United States is of a whole different order of magnitude. It's difficult to comprehend, coming from this part of the world, just how ideologically radioactive the issue can be, to the point where people avoid using certain words. What we're seeing in the industry is a rollback. There's unquestionably that. And what's happening as a consequence of it is pressure back on investors in this part of the world to say, if you guys get too fussy, we're just going to go to the US where they don't ask us these annoying questions. I hope it doesn't come to that, because that would be, again, tragic, but it's a risk. the capital markets are very fluid and they're interconnected.
And so perhaps we could turn to the energy transition now and to Europe in a post-war in Ukraine world. And I guess it's affecting different companies differently. But it's interesting what you were saying there, because I think that for us, for Ignio's portfolio, the conflict has actually only accelerated our energy transition targets. And so I'll take, for example, Utilitas, which is our Estonian renewable energy producer that still has some natural gas in its heat production at the moment. When we bought the company, it was about 50% natural gas, 50% biomass. It's now 75% biomass, and I think that will be higher again this year. And they have a target to be zero carbon by 2030, and that's not net zero, that's actually zero carbon. We're now accelerating that after the conflict, because what we saw when gas prices were so high, the investments Utilitas had made in diversifying its energy production mix shielded it from those insane price rises. Plus, it provides Estonia with a sustainable, but crucially locally sourced supply of energy. And so it's green and it's local, but it's got security of supply. And in this case, it gave them production around crazy price changes. So we've accelerated our investment plan to achieve zero carbon at Utilitas, and we're hoping we'll meet our targets by 2027 now. What are the biggest challenges to Europe's energy transition over, say, the next decade? And perhaps more interestingly for us, at least, what are the biggest opportunities?
Well, first of all, I think what you described at Utilitas and your other companies is a microcosm of what is happening certainly in Europe, even though it may seem like three steps forward, two steps back a lot of the time, because initially when the shock happened, there was a mad scramble to secure alternative sources of LNG. And that objectively is what did happen, but LNG is expensive. It's expensive. It's the infrastructure involved, as I think you know, in liquefying and then regasifying is expensive. And it only amortizes over an extensive period of time. So it's not something that you want to lock in on too great a scale. You have to get some in order to get yourself through this cold winter and the next two or three. But really what it has done is triggered a realization that not just that we have to eliminate our dependency on Russian gas, but we have to eliminate our dependency on gas, period. And that is, I think, a very salutary outcome. I think Mr. Putin has overplayed his hand, and that will be an interesting legacy that he has left to his country. But as I said, it can look like three steps forward, two steps back, particularly when you have government policies that kind of flip-flop around in order to curry favor with certain parts of the electorate, and that's never a good thing. Generally, I completely agree, and I think in terms of the biggest challenges, and I see this very clearly, actually, I saw it when I was in Eni, where the company was ramping up renewable energy production. And then when the war happened, accelerated even more. But of course, as we all know, the difficulty is getting connections to the grid. And now that I work for the grid company, I'm seeing it from the other side, and the pressures on all the grid operators to multiply. I mean, it's not just increased by 20%. It's multiplied by 2, 3, 4. Their capacity is very, very difficult to achieve, because even though we don't compete with one another, we have monopolies in our respective local markets, we compete for the same supplies and the same people, right? There's a shortage of skills and there's a shortage of key equipment, whether it's cables or compressors or whatever that stuff is. There's not enough of it. And by the way, some of the key suppliers were Russian. So they're off the table as well in terms of sourcing that. So I do think that whenever you have a supply squeeze, you have opportunity, right? So I do think there will be opportunities there to plug those gaps, and in ways that have not been done before. We have to do things differently from the way we did them. And just generally speaking, there's going to be far, far more dependence on infrastructure, large scale, but also small scale. And I think there's going to be 1,000 flowers blooming to deliver on these opportunities. So running an infrastructure fund is a good place to be.
We are seeing lots of investment opportunities coming out of the acceleration of Europe's energy transition targets. We just recently invested in a company called DAH Group, which is a biogas and biomethane production company in Germany. So yeah, lots of tailwinds for sure. But as you say, some bottlenecks as well.
Well, biogas is a perfect example of the bottlenecks, because the chemistry is very clear. And it really is, with minor sort of filtering and so forth, it is eminently substitutable. The problem is getting enough of it, enough of the raw material. And the difficulty there, as I'm sure you've discovered, is the fracturing of the supply chain. So there's a real need to consolidate access to supplies. I have to say, I'm so impressed with what you're doing at Ignio, because having an owner that completely backs this agenda is vital, because I think oftentimes management gets mixed signals from its shareholders. I certainly saw that in the listed markets, particularly, as I mentioned, when the war broke out. You know, first we're getting one thing, then we're getting the other. And you can't run a company that way. You need to have consistency.
Sustainable, long-term value creation.
Absolutely, yeah. Right. And not just words. Mm. Real, genuine commitment backed up by action and backed up by capital.
Absolutely. That's what we aim to do. Thank you very much, Karina.
Thank you, Sophie.
Thank you for listening to Keeping It Real Assets, the Ignio Infrastructure Partners podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, you can listen to more by following Ignio Infrastructure Partners on your favorite podcast platform. If you'd like to find out more about Ignio Infrastructure Partners, you can visit our website at ignioip.com. This podcast series was produced by Mark Gardner at OX4 Sound Studio. This podcast is not a financial promotion and has been prepared for general information purposes only. It is not intended to be investment or financial advice and does not take into account the specific investment objectives, financial situation, or needs of any particular person. References to specific securities should not be construed as a recommendation to buy or sell such securities. Investment vehicles managed by Ignio Infrastructure Partners are only available to institutional investors, professional investors, qualified investors, and wholesale clients. They are not available to retail clients, the general public, private customers, or any persons in any jurisdiction in which their distribution is not authorized. Ignio Infrastructure Partners is an unlisted infrastructure asset management business and is part of the First Sentier Investors Group. We communicate and conduct business through different legal entities in different locations. Please refer to the notes section of the podcast platform you use for more information on Ignio Infrastructure Partners in your region. For Singapore only, the podcast should be used in accordance with the applicable laws in Singapore. In Singapore, the podcast is issued by First Sentier Investors Singapore, whose company registration number is 19690042D. This advertisement or material has not been reviewed by the Monetary Authority of Singapore. First Sentier Investors registration number 53236800B and Ignio Infrastructure Partners registration number 53447928J are business divisions of First Sentier Investors Singapore.